Today's Taisho is case 46 in the Mumonkan, the Umen Kwan. Proceed on from the top of the pole. Sekiso Osho said, how can you proceed on further from the top of a 100-foot pole? Another eminent teacher of old said, you sit on the top of a 100-foot pole. Although you have entered the way, you are not yet genuine. Proceed on from the top of the pole, and you will show your whole body in the 10 directions. Mumon's comment, if you go on further and turn your body about, no place is left where you are not the master. Even so, tell me, how will you go on further from the top of the 100-foot pole, eh? Mumon's verse, he darkens the third eye of insight and clings to the first mark on the scale. Even though he may sacrifice his life, he is still only a blind man leading the blind. This is day 4 of our October Sesshin, and it's another stunningly, amazingly beautiful day. It's especially beautiful because we've been practicing for the last 3 days Zazen, and we've been purifying body, mind, heart, and simplifying our lives so that it's quite possible to be absolutely thrilled by the sound of the wind, or by the feeling of the sun on your face. It's just, it's like winning the lottery, right? So beautiful, so wonderful. I have been at home a lot this semester working on some projects. And I have a very nice workspace. I get to look outside from my window over a wooded area, and across the street from where I live, there's a very big house, and it's an older neighborhood, and the person who built it, it's sort of like a mansion, and so basically it's this giant house that was built in the 1920s or so. And the backyard has a bunch of trees. And so the lot across from my house never got developed. And so I sit there working on my word processor, and I can look out the window all day at this beautiful, you know, these beautiful pine and maple trees. And on a day like today, you know, when the wind is blowing, they're shimmering in the wind, and every once in a while, I have to communicate with people through the email. And I remember writing a colleague in the English department, and I said, isn't it a beautiful day? And basically, he wrote back and said, what makes it so beautiful, or something like that. So, you know, basically, what's so beautiful about it? You know, that was what he said. And, you know, the idea was that he's caught up in, I'm sure he never even noticed, you know, what a beautiful day it was. I'm sure, you know, he got up, he went into his car, he drove to work, and he was probably thinking about all these details and all these problems, and he went into his office, and then he's an administrator, so you know, the phone was ringing, he was answering his word, his email, and people were coming in and yelling at him or complaining or crying or I know for a fact that he's a very nice guy actually, but he's on antidepressants and so on, and This is sort of like not one way to live life, yeah? And it's so wonderful, we're so lucky to have the opportunity to practice like this and just sit with the mushing for, we have 5 days of this beautiful path, purifying body, mind, and heart. And it's just, and it's just exquisite, right? Just hearing the crickets, it's, sometimes life is so precious, it's so beautiful that if it ended right there, it'd be okay, right? And I've had moments like that off the cushion. I remember when I was young, I finished college, and I went out west to do some backpacking up in the mountains in New Mexico. And my friend Larry Sullivan and I had planned this trip for like 4 years when we were in college. We would get Outsider magazine and read it and think, we've just got to go out there, And so we went out and we had a blast. It was great. We weren't far from the area where Imtiaz was this summer. And I was actually north of Santa Fe in the Pecos Mountains. And, basically we had been up in the mountains for more than a week. And I really wanted, we were going to go down into town. And I knew that I had been sweating every day and basically just washing my face. So I bathed in a stream, but it was a very powerful stream, and I lost my footing. And the stream carried me. It wasn't a very powerful stream, or I probably would have been killed, but it was pretty powerful. And I lost my footing on some rocks, and it took me a ways down the stream, and I was bouncing on all these rocks, and I came to a shallow place. And it occurred to me, wow, that could have been it, if I had hit my head on something I looked around and, there were all these aspen trees and these firs. And it's just like, honestly, I just felt in my heart, if that was it, that's it, this has been a wonderful day, beautiful day. And I feel that way sometimes sitting, where you're just on the cushion and you just hear the wind or you hear the crickets, and it's like, if my life ended right here, it's perfectly fine, because it's like there's a way of thinking where we keep thinking, I don't have 100% yet, I don't have 100% yet, and we're always trying to get that 100%. So, maybe you have a job you like, but you're not, company president, So that would be 100%. And so maybe you're vice president, so you have 60% or something like that. People think that way, right? A friend of mine wanted to very badly have children, and basically my sister. I was trying to conceal the identity. Well, my sister wanted to be a nurse, and she became a nurse and had worked in an oncology ward for a long time, and then she had the opportunity to become like a nurse practitioner. So she went back to school and did that, and she got involved in lots of different things at the hospital where she works, and she never managed to meet the appropriate person. And she finally did, quite late in life, meet a very nice guy named Barney, her husband. And so she was almost, she was in her mid-30s, I guess, when she got married, and her husband was, he's my age, so he was, he's, you know, in his 50s now, he was probably in his late 40s at that time. And he was such a wonderful man, and my sister was so lucky to find him, because she had gone with some people that neither I nor the rest of my family really liked her very much, you know. There was one guy she was going with, we were terrified she was going to marry, because he was really not a nice guy. He was a manipulative person, he was kind of a bully, and you know, I was really disturbed by this, and very worried, you know. So I was so happy when my sister dumped him. And but anyway, you know, she finally she wanted to be married. Not everybody wants to be married, and there's no one right way to live. So basically, she felt the need to be married, and she got married. And she married finally, miraculously, this nice guy, you know. Even my brother even said that at the wedding. He said, it's a miracle that, you know, my sister's finally gotten hooked up with somebody, you know, my brother, he was funny. He said, somebody who's not a loser. See, my brother could be funny. He was very cynical, but he could be very funny. So anyway, she had a wonderful relationship with this guy, and he was like very patient, you know. He was married like, I don't know, 30 years ago, something like that. He worked as a high school teacher for 25 years, and then finished teaching high school and became I want to be a nurse. He said, I've had it with teaching, I want to help people in a different way. So he became a nurse, and that's how he met my sister. And so he's just a very, very nice guy. And they got married. You know, I'd call him and I'd say, well, what's up, Laura? She said, oh, we went aqua skiing today. That's not the right word, but you know those motorcycles on skis that you ride on the water? It's bad enough, right, that they're on land, right? There are those horrible motorcycles. But there's actually ones for the water, too. We're not content with tearing up the land. We have to go on. So anyway, they bought these aqua deals, whatever they are, and they would do this, and they did parachuting and all this stuff. And so I'd say, well, how's it going? Well, she said, great, you know, we did this and this. And I said, well, that's wonderful. She said, yeah, it's okay. And so, you know, basically she wanted to have a kid. So she had 60%, right? Now she has her kids, and I call her up, and, you know, and she's happy, but it's a different kettle of fish, right? You know, it's like, oh, I'm so exhausted, blah, 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 and all these kids, you know, blah, blah, blah. So she still has 60%, you know. But maybe it's the 60% she wanted, you know. But the people are like that, right? You know, they often feel they have what may be. Some people feel they only have 40%. Well, you know, there are people who have a mindset of being impoverished all the time. And my father was like that. My father always felt like he was looking in a window at a beautiful house. And inside, everybody was having a wonderful life, and he was out on the street. Really, I loved my dad, but that was his world, you know. My father grew up in Elizabeth, New Jersey, and my grandfather was a car mechanic. And during the Great Depression, my father grew up in the Great Depression, like millions of Americans, and he was really very poor, and it bothered him tremendously that he didn't have the good things in life. Like, my father went to school in Converse sneakers. They were kind of sneakers that has become very cool now, as a matter of fact. They are a high-top sneaker, black, they're sort of, now they sell checkered ones and things like that, but back in the 1930s, those were not, or in the late 20s and early 30s, those were not cool. Those were like poor people's shoes. And my father would wear, you know, Converse sneakers to class, and you know, people would make fun of him because he didn't have leather shoes, you know. And so when my father basically grew up and became an adult, he had a closet full of shoes. And he used to buy a very expensive kind of shoe, and on a Saturday he'd get all his shoes out and shine them up, you know, really. But having the shoes wasn't good enough, you know, because he still felt like he wasn't there. So this is like a common mentality. And my father, he could get all his shoes out, but he still didn't feel like he had arrived. He was where he wanted to be. And it's okay to have goals. Please understand, I'm not criticizing having goals. That's okay. But some people do have like a poverty mentality. They just feel that they're always looking on inside, you know. My father refused to touch a wrench in his whole life. He was lucky after the war. He got to go to college on the GI Bill. Government sent him to college because he had served in the Navy. And my father he didn't want to know how to fix a car. He didn't want to know anything about cars. And indeed, he didn't know anything about cars, and he owned terrible cars that were, you know, pieces of junk. And my grandfather would just shake his head. He goes, "Oh my God, you bought another Plymouth, Larry. You know, just saying, it's a piece of junk." You know? My father wanted this, you know, the car that said, "I have arrived," you know. And he couldn't afford it, so he always got like the car that was trying to arrive but couldn't quite arrive. Because it was broken down on the side of the road, you know. So my father always wanted to be in the Navy, and he wanted to be like an admiral, but he didn't even get close. And then he worked in the government service, the civilian service. And he wanted to be in the government. You get a rating. You're like a government service 7, 8, 9. So it's like you actually have a rating. He's a 10 and you're a 9. So they make it very clear that there's a hierarchy. And the administrators who are more senior are 14s and up. And so my father got to 13 and he couldn't become a 14. And it literally, I mean, my father had a serious drinking problem, and it literally drove him crazy that he couldn't become a 14. He was very unhappy, that man. And I learned, I'm so in debt to my father, because his unhappiness made me realize I just don't want to be unhappy like that, you know? I just don't want to, and I wish I could pay him back for the great gift he's given me. Because his suffering was so obvious to me at some point, and you know, I just thought there must be another way to live. You know, it's a big influence on my life. A person who used to sit with us, who stopped sitting with us, at the end of one sashini came up and he said, "You know, all you ever do is talk about your father. You have a bad father fixation." You know, I said, "Maybe so." But anyway, he had 40%, right? He felt he had 40%. But every once in a while, you know, the thing is, if you don't expect anything, you get everything. You know, I think that's true. You know, if you don't expect anything, everything is wonderful. This is like the secret, I think, or one of the secrets of Zen. You know, we sit on the cushion and we just cut away all the inessentials, right? And you come to Sashin thinking, "I'm going to have an enlightenment experience." And then you realize, well, that's not going to happen. And then you're going through the process and you think, well, maybe at least if I'm not going to have enlightenment, I can at least answer my koan. But then you think, well, that may not happen either, right? You know? And then, you know, you can think, well, this is a bunch of crap or whatever, and you can go through various kinds of negative feelings and you get to say, you know, I'm never going to amount to anything, blah, 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 blah. But at some point, if you stay, if you don't leave, you're just on the cushion, and you might even wonder, what am I doing here? You know, what am I doing here? And that's a great place to be. You know, it's a great place to be, in my opinion. Because now it's possible to really experience something new, you know, and really experience. I hope I'm making some sense, you know. We get so caught in our cultural conditioning. I mean, our basic problem is that we have all of this cultural conditioning, you know, and we're constantly trying to live out the desires and aspirations of others, you know, for us. Or maybe they're not for us personally, but somebody created them, right? It creates all of these anxieties about where we should be and who we should be and what we should do and so on. And it has this haunting effect on our lives. It makes us profoundly unhappy, you know. And the problem is, you know, we get these conflicting messages, you know. So, you know, even my own parents gave me conflicting messages. So my father actually didn't want me to go into the military, you know, which was a good thing. So when I was growing up, he was always encouraging me to go to college, and when I got to college, He wanted me to study anything I was interested in. See, so I mean, he said study what you find interesting. Because my father was the first person in his family to go to college, and when he went to college, he studied history. He became a history major, and it was one of the things he loved most about his life was learning about history. And so he had remembered that, and when I went to college, he said, study whatever you like, you know, whatever, and that was great advice, you know. But my mother was totally different, you know, I was very good in the sciences, you know, and my mother kept saying, Kurt, you know, she never said become a doctor, she said be a medical man. She'd put her palms facing the sky, right? Her palms would be facing the sky and her fingers would be curled up, and she'd push her hands forward and she'd go, Kurt, be a medical man. I think she was in love with this doctor in the town where we lived, Dr. Pittman, and I think she just thought he was like a god, right? And so she kept saying, and I said, Mom, I think I'm going to major in English. And she, oh, you're throwing your life away. You know? You could be a medical man. You could write your own ticket, right? You know? So it was just like she literally, her face would just flinch with pain. You know, oh, you're throwing your life. Kurt, be a medical man. So you get nervous, right, if you're not a medical man, right? You're sitting in English class, and you're thinking, you're reading these poems, and, you know, maybe your roommate is a business major, and there's nothing wrong with being a business major, because that's his aspiration. But, you know, I was in a house, like I wasn't in a fraternity, but I was a boarder in a house where we rented rooms. This was where I went to school. And there were all different kinds of people who were in this house, you know. One of them was like an engineer. And man, as graduation approached, he had job offers, right? You know, it was like job offers. You mean people are offering you a job, you know? Because I was an English major, right? I was an English major thinking, and I wasn't a very smart English major either. I was thinking, what is a job anyway, you know? Where do you get one, you know? Do you look in the paper, you know? And so this guy had, you know, he had jobs lined up, you know? I mean, lined up, and he was flying out like an adult, you know? So it was an amazing thing. And I had planned absolutely zero, you know. So it's possible to be sitting in class, reading a beautiful poem, and think, this is wonderful. But then all of a sudden you hear the voice of your mother, and she's saying, you're throwing your life away, right? You know, and then you can come home and think, God, maybe I am throwing my life away, you know. Then they hear your father's voice. He says, do what you like, you know. No, you're throwing your life away, you know. So this is going on all the time, right? I mean, and then it's not just the parents, but society is sending you all kinds of messages about what will make you happy, right? What will make you happy. And of course, your parents really love you, probably, right? But society doesn't necessarily love you. It just wants to manipulate you. So it's sending you all kinds of messages which aren't benign, that might even be taking advantage of you. You know, you must have this, you know. And it's just a sales pitch, right? But if you don't have it, you feel like dirt, or you feel inferior, you know. Even though we might think, I'm a rational being, I'm sure I'm not taken in by any of this stuff. I'm sure I'm making my own decisions. Actually, it's very, very difficult to make our own decisions. It's very, very difficult because there's all of these voices in our head creating anxieties, telling us to go left, telling us to go right. So this is part of the complexity of Zen practice, right? It's one of the reasons we can't have 100%. Because we're constantly comparing this moment to something we think it should be, right? You know, a lot of Zen practice involves, a lot of the preliminary part of Zen practice is just learning how to be in the moment without drawing on or trying to get directions from the advice of others, you know? A lot of Zen practice is just learning how to accept the moment for what it really is, and to really see the moment. You know? And that's actually very difficult. When we're having an experience of the moment, we have all of these expectations about what it should be. You know, and some of them are, some of them come from our culture, some of them come from personal experience, you know. If you ask somebody, just watch the breath, you know, and they go sit down, and you know, we've had a lot of people a few days ago who were beginners. This was their first sesshin experience. And I'm sure they were coming here with all these voices in their heads, and the voices were saying, you know, this is crazy, what am I doing here, you know, and so on. And they were hearing the voice of their mother or their father saying, don't do this, do that. And so there's that level of confusion. And then they have other kinds of expectations too, right? I mean, they're thinking, you know, maybe they're going to come to sesshin and I'm going to give them some special mantra, and they'll sit down on the cushion and start vibrating, you know, or floating, or light will come out like a comic book, and light will come out their forehead or something. And instead, you know, there's all this sitting, you know, and so on. And I keep saying, please just watch the breath, or become one with the breath. And people want to have a certain kind of experience from the moment. You know, they want to have a breakthrough. All is one, you know. But so it's very hard. For so many reasons, people underestimate the importance of all this stuff in their heads. It's very, very hard just to be present in the moment and to see it as it really is without trying to impose some kind of a meaning on it or some kind of a structure on it, or getting some result out of it. You know, this is very, very basic Zen 101. But it's a big problem. It's a huge problem. And so our method in Zen is to work with the breath until you can enter deep samadhi. And a deep samadhi is a stabilized mind in which the split between, if you wanted to put it in an abstract way, this subject and object is not so intensely present. So normally, as you're going through life, you're watching life at a distance, right? You're having experiences, right? So normally, you're a lot of time people are actually imagining themselves as characters in their own story. And if you're a writer, you may have a particular disease where you walk into a room and you go, he entered the room, right? He turned. He caught her eye, right? You know, as this is all happening, you're sort of narrating. This is like a kind of mental illness, actually, you know. Because you're intensifying your sense of separation. Now, I love novels and novelists and so on, so maybe they have to do this. But when you're doing Zen, you know, one of the lovely things is that this can stop, and that you're watching the breath, you're watching the breath, and for a while you're thinking, ah, here I am watching the breath. I'm in a story, and now I've gone to a sesshin in my story, and I'm watching the breath, and in just a minute, the story is going to end, and it's going to end with, and then the light burst through, right? Or it's going to end, and then the session was over, and as usual, I was a fail, you know, or something like that, right? You know, so, but every once in a while, you sit on the cushion and you watch the breath, and what happens instead is quite wonderful, because it's just like you forget about the character you're supposed to be, and your attention is totally absorbed by the moment. Now, this doesn't happen. It's not like you sit down and this goes on for half an hour. But you have moments where this actually happens. And you may not even think about it because, of course, your self-consciousness just disappears. But you start having a kind of unified mind in accord with the way, right? You start unified mind. And this is a major breakthrough. When people begin to have this experience, it's a major achievement. And it may take a long time. I myself worked with the breath koan for 5 years, or 4 years. Maybe it felt like five, but it was a long time, you know. Because I was so, I read a lot of novels, and I kept wanting something to happen that was newsworthy, or that would have been a very good story by James Joyce or something like that, you know. And I couldn't just, drop it. The great Japanese teacher Dogen said, to practice Zen is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. See, and you don't have to try to forget the self, just try to be one with your breath, and at some point you stop evaluating. The evaluator stops, the narrator stops, and you're just in the moment, see. And that's wonderful. And same thing with Mu practice, you know. You're calling Mu, you're calling Mu, you're calling Mu, but at some point, well, you know, when we're doing Mu practice, naturally we want to have a breakthrough. I mean, it's no secret that something is supposed to happen. And so you're sitting there, and maybe it's possible for you to enter this state where your mind is occasionally dark and blank, or blank. This blank mind is absolutely crucial. And you're waiting to have something happen. And, you know, the art of Zen is, The art of Zen is to stop forming concepts, right? So, you know, when concept formation stops, you're simply purely in the presence of this blank mind. Then, of course, concept formation starts again and you say, oh, nothing is happening. Why isn't something happening? I'm getting older. This is my 10th sesshin, etc., you know. But every once in a while, concept formation stops or it comes close to stopping and you're just in the presence of this blank mind. This is the art of the mu koan. This is really crucial for this to happen. So it may only happen once in a sit, it may even happen just once in a day, but you want to keep going back to that blank mind, and for just little intervals, the mind that says this is only 40% or this is only 60% just is silenced, and the pure presence of this blankness is there. And when we're when we stop discriminating, and we're in the pure presence of the blankness, we say in Zen, you become one with the blankness. Right? And if you're truly one with the blankness, then the time issue ceases to matter. Right? You're no longer so concerned about outcome. Outcome mind is not the mind that you need. You know, you just have to be totally in this moment. Whatever it is 100%. You know, and so you know, basically we live in with goals and we live in time, but you can't really experience something new, something genuinely new, if you keep trying to make it fit what you've always believed to be true. So you have to put mom and dad's voice aside, you have to put the voice of other authorities aside, and all these voices that cause us anxiety and fear and so on. And we just have to give up, have to try, and then just be in the presence of the moment. This is, I know, difficult. In fact, it may even be a little terrifying, but you can do it, you know. Now to the koan. We have 5 minutes left, so Mumon's comment. If you go here it is. Sekiso Osho said, "How can you proceed on further from the top of a 100-foot pole?" Okay, so this is really a wonderful koan. You know, first of all, let me point out it's a koan. Right, it's a story. It's a metaphor. Nobody should climb up the pole and jump off. Okay, but we know what would happen, right? If you go up the pole and you're at the top of like a flagpole, and you're somehow standing on the pole, our experience, voice of the past, tells us, don't step off. You'll be killed. Right. So this is sort of how we feel all the time. Anytime we're in the presence of something new, right, we feel this way, you know. In other words, you know, when you're really in the moment, when you're really 100% in the moment, it is a little frightening because you don't know what to do next. You don't know what should be happening next, right? And, if you're working on a koan other than mu or the breath koan, sometimes they're asking you to deal with elements of your own life. You know, they're asking you to deal with elements of how you live. And, in those koans too, you sort of have to put the road maps away and just trust the moment to have a kind of... The moment will tell you what to do, how can you proceed on further from the top of a 100-foot pole? You know, no matter how long you practice, it's just like this. You know, you could, no matter how many sesshins you've come to, no matter how many koans you've worked with, every time it's the same thing. It's like you're out on a limb, you don't know where to turn, you don't know what to do next, right? And it's uncomfortable. It's like standing on a big pole. And you know that, you know, you're probably going to get hurt, right? You were afraid of being hurt, in some way being injured. Because we don't trust the moment itself to be sufficient, you know, to teach us something, show us what we need to know. So this is like the way it feels sometimes to do Zen practice. How can you proceed on further from the top of the 100-foot pole? Another eminent teacher of old said, "You who sit on the top of a 100-foot pole, although you have entered the way, you are not genuine." In other words, look, you may have done 20 sesshin, you may have done 50 sesshin, but you're not going to answer your koan if you don't embrace this kind of uncertainty. See? Zen practice isn't about getting better and better and better. The more sesshin you do, the more skillful you don't become. That's just not true. What you get better at is tolerating uncertainty. See, you get better at tolerating this state of not knowing where to go, not knowing what you should be seeing or experiencing. And you get used to jumping off the pole, and it's actually the most wonderful thing, right? It's terrifying not to know. It's terrifying not to have those voices in your head telling you what should be the case. But really, you know, there is a deeper order to things. It doesn't have to be forced onto the world. It comes right out of this moment. You know, we don't believe that. It's very hard for us to believe that. But it's true, you know. So he says, you know, you've been practicing, you've been doing a lot of sesshin, but you're just holding on to the top of the pole. You have to jump off. You know, you have to, over and over again, what people get good at in Zen, it's not answering koans, it's tolerating not knowing. It's tolerating not knowing. And, you know, being in that state of not knowing, of having an empty mind and waiting for something to happen and not knowing, this is like, all I can say is, if you stay there long enough, it's the most beautiful, wonderful, sacred thing in the world, purifying. You know, if you're working with the breath or you're working with your mu koan and you're coming in to sit and you don't know what's supposed to be happening and you think, all right, my mind is blank, I'm watching my breath, nothing's happening, but it's so wrong. You know, you're really, I mean, if I may say so, that might not be a politically correct way to put it, you know. But you're so wrong. Because you, unbeknownst to you, you know, you're changing and changing. And sitting in the presence of that blankness, hour after hour, day after day, is like transforming you completely into a totally different person. And the same thing, watching your breath hour after hour, day after day, is changing you. You won't be the same person. At the end of the session, you might say, I don't feel any different, but just keep going. I mean, many of the people in this room have been doing sesshin for years now. And all I can say is, at least from my perspective, you're very different people than you were when you walked into a room B103 at Livingston so many years ago. Very different people. And you may not want to be different, right? That's another level of confusion, right? You know, sometimes people have divided minds about this, right? because we are expected to have a certain kind of identity, right? And maybe we are comfortable playing that, but when you come to do your Zen practice, you become a very different person, you know? And at some point that may be a koan too, right? Whether you want to be that old person or you want to be the person you become on the cushion. But from my perspective, I think all of you are very different people than you were, you know, X number of years ago. And you just have confidence in this process. Trust the moment, you know. And time doesn't matter. You know, it's a big mistake to say, oh boy, I've been practicing for 10 years, I've only answered X number of koans, you know, at this rate I'll be 152, you know. I've been doing this for 30 some years now. And I just feel like I'm just beginning to get it, you know. Really. Honestly. I mean, you know, I think if, I mean, you read, you know, the world of like spiritual gurus and all this stuff is, it's just insane too, right? You know, so you'll read some guru or some swami or some lama, you know, or some, he had his great enlightenment experience. He was 23 and he had a Dai Kensho and now he's teaching and he's 26, you know. And, you know, that's just baloney. You know, that's pure baloney. You know, even if you can encounter the source, you have to sit with it for a long time before it really transforms you, right? I mean, in Zen practice, you know, there's a classic classic convention, I don't know how to put it, there's kind of like an unofficial rule in Zen practice. And of course in America people don't observe this, but I myself did. And it's like this, if you look at Wei Nang, you look at a lot of the great Zen teachers, usually they wait 10 years after their Dai Kensho before they begin to teach. And it's called effacing your traces, erasing your traces. See? And that, you might think, what does that mean? Does that mean, you know, having Dai Kensho, you go up into the mountains and you know, make sure nobody can find you? Is that right? It's clearing up your karma, you know, clearing up karmic residue. So, you know, Zen practice takes a long time, but then, you know, even after Dai Kensho, what's the hurry? You know, basically spend 10 years cleaning up your karma a little bit. So the point is, you know, if you want to practice Zen, you have to be resigned to you know, this is something else I owe to my dad. You know, my father kept hoping he was going to become a 14. I told you that. He was the perpetual government service 13. And in his more optimistic moments, my father would say, I think I'm going to get it this year. You know, sad, right? And he'd say, you know, I'm a late bloomer. I think I'm going to get it this year. And of course, it never came. So. But, you know, actually, what makes life wonderful is always here. You know, as I said, I learned so much from my father's suffering, you know. Because, you know, well, let me put it this way. I'm a late bloomer, yeah? And if you want to practice Zen, you have to be resigned, that's not the right word. You want to be a late bloomer. You want to be a late bloomer. See, I'm just getting started on this beautiful path. You know, I'm just a baby. I've only been doing this for 30 years. And I'm not being disingenuous. I just feel like I've just started to do Zen. And I, you know, it's very interesting. You know, even today, it's so interesting. So I think that means it's a lie, right? You know, if you do something for 30 years and think, oh, been there, done that, you know, that says something about what you've been doing. You know, there's something wrong with what you're doing. But if you do something for 30 years and you say, you know, I'm just getting started, and you feel it, yeah, this is just the beginning. I want to be a late bloomer, you know? There's so much more to experience about this beautiful universe. anyway, please think about being a late bloomer. It's not so bad, okay? And while you're at it, you know, jump off the 100-foot pole.